modern society being one where the success model and achievement is what is important. And that leads again into a very stressful way of living, and one which is often dominated by fear. And Bakken is then left in that personal dilemma that he sees himself in the role of the expert, which is a rather powerful role in our society, which gives a lot of power to experts. And what is Bakken's concern is to try to pay attention to the spiritual need, which is again the need for wholeness, which he sees as lacking in our society. And he sees that as a natural need which has been neglected and which is necessary for us again to get in touch with in order to achieve that wholeness, both within society as such, relationships, within healthcare, within our personality. And he sees spirituality as that which will restore our wholeness. And he sees spirituality as a means of healing, or the means of healing. And therefore he talks about sickness, not in the narrow sense, but as an injury to the whole person. And healthcare is healing of the person and not only of a separate ailment. And for healing, God has given us the unity of medical, psychological, and spiritual healing. And the problem is that that the concept of healing has not only dropped out in society, but has also dropped out as a part of the church ministry. And by spirituality, he means a spirituality which is lived. And I take that to mean that it is spirituality integrated in our personality and in the way we live. It is a spirituality which is basically a transformation towards wholeness, a wholeness in which we can also perceive the meaning of life. And secondly, spirituality is a change of our worldview from a neutral worldview or lifestyle to a more open and engaged and integrated worldview. And we talked about whether perhaps neutral is in one way a good word, but perhaps neutral living also implies destructive living. Simply because the consequences of a neutral living will be destructive. So we need that change from neutral living to an involved, engaged living. And on the basis of this view, Bakken is critical of the secular worldview, because it doesn't allow for the spiritual dimension. And a key term to describe the secular worldview is the Cartesian view, which dates back to the philosopher Descartes, who in his philosophy sees a human being mainly in terms of our rational capacity. And that means that on one hand body is let out, and on the other hand spirit is let out. So it's not a view that allows for wholeness, it's a view that is dualistic. And that again has led to the biomedical model within healthcare, where a human being is seen as a biological entity that can be treated, the body can be treated. It doesn't take into consideration healing of also the other parts of us. And it has also led to our almost idolatry of high technology and experts in our society. And Bakand operates from the assumption that God ultimately wants our healing. And he sees spirituality again, and within that, prayer as means to healing. And he sees relationships, and there again the church comes in as possibly a healing community. And he talks about the necessity of our being open, our being responsive and receptive. He even talks about our desiring or craving God or healing or wholeness. And in that he challenges the traditional or the Lutheran tradition, which has one-sidedly put the emphasis on God's initiative and God's grace. And he tries to make up for that by saying, as far as I see it, that it is a kind of communication through which a transformation can start. And he sees the call as a luring force in an upward spiral of integration. He talks about that we must try to set our mind on an upward spiral instead of a downward spiral of disintegration. And he talks in terms of the necessity of a paradigm shift from fear, which is that which destroys and separates, that interrelatedness which is true reality. So we need a paradigm shift from that fear which separates to love which casts out that fear and is the healing power and is what leads us on our spiritual journey in which leads to Christ. His spirituality is very Christ-centered. Christ as the basis of it, and Christ as the way, and Christ as the aim of it. And spirituality is also a lifestyle of simplicity. Simplicity is an inward reality that results in an outward lifestyle, he says. And he talks about this paradigm shift in ways that I think almost equal conversion, but conversion understood as transformation, an inner and an outer transformation. And that conversion having both an inner and an outer aspect means that our personal well-being is interrelated to social justice and peace and the well-being of people in general and of creation. And he finally says that to be human is to be in community. So, and he sees loneliness as what is detrimental of that, would that be the word? So spirituality is not only a personal journey, but it is also a social journey. I think that's about them. I want to say that leaves us with how much time?
We'll take roughly 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Would
four in each group?
I wondered if we could have the, since there's 9 participants, if we could have them just starting, Greg, you don't have to be like this, but just to get you divided. Greg, Alana, John, if you could be in one group, Anna, Kevin, Ron in one, and you three in one, and then the rest, us four, and we'll welcome you two, hope you'll join us too. We'll spread ourselves among your three groups. The idea being that we'd like the three of you in each group to lead off with sharing your thoughts, concerns, and try to make sure that you all in the next 20 minutes have a chance to bring out the ideas and thoughts that you had as you went through, and the rest of us will join in too, but that you all have your chance to.
I wonder if your group would start like if you have anything you want to contribute. Just throw out a few things.
Trying to understand the particular angelic and demonic forces, and then the other part, forces of evil. Look at the picture as a whole, try to interpret that, what it's talking about. Some said self, some said the worldview.
I think maybe it's both, actually, because he states that to try and represent man's relation.
Human's relation.
Humanity.
Sorry.
To me, man.
To these words. Mm-hmm. And did you find it helpful? I mean, do you find that it's, you agree with his setting up of our...
Personally, I find it rather confusing and don't necessarily agree with that illustration. Mm-hmm. Like you point very little in the physical world.
Mm-hmm. I think that in it can be seen both the old paradigm, which would be kind of to the right of that vertical line, where, you know, human beings have been equivalated with their consciousness only, and that the Christian message addressed our consciousness by means of the word, the message. And then what Bachman wants to is to also integrate the left side there, and tries to show how extensive that side is, and that we need both for the wholeness.
Some of our discussion, which dealt with the question of integration of so many facets, and we were getting into Christian treatment in our society and some of those things, and then Carolyn pointed out on 40, the second to the bottom paragraph, that states our values. Attitudes, beliefs, and habit patterns, etc. Picked up on that. also shared that his methanoia, the vision, which I can't relate to in a closed prison. I don't feel I've had one, don't necessarily need to have it. Makes me wonder how many people do and what they're like. Maybe some of them have repeated experiences.
We talked some about the different ways that conversion can take place, and whether conversion is something that, you know, it's an event that brings you from an old state of being to a new state of being, or whether it's more like a transformation, which I can better relate to. But I think we agreed that even if, for people who have a strong experience of conversion, spirituality still has to take the form of a journey or a transformation.
It's not necessarily so sudden or so stark.
No. But that state of being is not something that you then for good possess and then you're... that you have to work at it and grow in it. What were the other groups like?
I guess we had a lot of active discussion in our group, which was fun. I guess the diagram on page 43 created some discussion on his definition of angelic and demonic forces, and how he differentiates that from a demonic force from a force of evil, and is that force of evil an independent entity or something within the psyche? And the other question we brought up was that on page 38 he talks about how Kelsey challenged the conclusions of most of the notable theologians and philosophers since the early 19th century, Kierkegaard, Bultmann, so on. What do you think he comes up with a theology or philosophy to interpret the experience of God?
Well, I think that this is kind of a strong statement, just to, you know, state these theologians without explaining why he's critical of them and what their theology is, but I think that he critiques them as theologians who disregard experience, religious spiritual experience, but they are still stuck with the idea that that the Christian message of God addresses only our mind, our consciousness. And therefore, they represent a dualistic theology because they separate mind from the rest of us. And he wants to integrate, you know, the whole person.
So he's disregarding all of the contributions they've made. Or just
no, I don't think that he would. Just reject it, but I think that he would say we need some more, we need to have something integrated because it is too one-sided.
Is thinking of the idea that possibly God has two wills...
Well, I didn't really want to say that. I wouldn't want to argue that. But what I would say
is that
he wants
that
the best
idea
for us, but that does not always mean consistent behavior or action for us.
But in... the only way we have of understanding how he might do that would be to act differently at different times, or to show his will differently at different times.
I think a better analogy to parents is that the parent is given to the child the ability to be obstreperous, angry, and even destructive by passing on genes. If you not always comfortable about saying it was God's image, so the image was lost, I think, too. You know, I didn't think we had much to go on in terms of our being God's image today, other than what you believe God's image is, one or other things. That's an interesting subject. But let's try that we are in God's image, which I have some questions about. Is then also he built into us the ability to mess up, I would say. And then that, for me, that would be a stronger analogy, because the other is, well, things might happen and we won't intervene, but here it's really in us to be sick, or to make ourselves sick, or to whatever else. That analogy would be stronger for me.
And that ability to make ourselves sick can't be given or separated from the ability to make ourselves whole and wholer and creative and just so mutual.
That's right. It would be, you might say, the other side or whatever, other dimension.
It reminds me of one time I read someplace, somebody said that the problem with having pets as child substitutes is that they never leave home.
Well, some kids are pets.
Thank God.
Anyone else have any thoughts on that, or on a different one that you chose?
I hope other people know. They feel different about that. They say that too. It's a point of view that you just were sharing.
I had a disagreement with number two, or a trouble with the definition, and that stating that spiritual reality includes the good and evil forces, which are different from reality in our day-to-day existence, but yet connected to it. And I guess the problem comes is, for me, is if they're different from our physical existence as we know it, how are they incarnated in what is their manifestation? If they're different from the world, yet connected to it. Are they independent bodies, or
what I will defend that statement, but isn't he talking? He's talking about the psyche.
I'm not so sure he is, because on 43, he's got that diagram, page 43.
The left side would be the psychoid.
That's a problem I have. Is that when he has this diagram, he states that forces of evil are outside of the psychic.
Okay, I'm taking the word psychoid just to mean the left side of that page, not psychic, my psyche, or the psychoid. I thought that's what he was meaning.
What do you mean by that?
Well, anything that isn't the physical, real kind of thing, going through this system, incarnate in the sense of in flesh, but that another reality is something that impinges on your human being, but it isn't enfleshed. It might be a numinous experience, or it might be thought, or it might be energy, or whatever else it might be. You know, that's what I read into what he was saying, and it might not be accurate.
But on the other hand, you wouldn't go so far as to say that there's no reality outside us, there's no spiritual reality, be it good or evil, outside our own psyche. I think there is, and then there is the interconnection of how spiritual reality influences us and can influence us both good or for evil. Or both. I mean, that's mixed up.
Well, I think he's contending that there's two spiritual realities, good and evil. And they're not connected, but separate entities. So in the spiritual world, we have two entities, a good force and an evil force. And then you come to the problem of evil again.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
I would say that it's basically true, but that it's too simplistic.
The word comes by hand, John.
Basically.
Basically. Yeah. Oh, just taught me too well. That's a great study, that's all.
I guess when I read that, I thought that it was saying what his diagram shows. It doesn't mean I agreed or disagreed, but that's what I got out of the diagram too, that he is saying that when he shows his dark and demonic forces there as both. Yeah. Right. When you. Anyone else have any more thoughts on that one for Greg?
May I just ask you, Greg, whether you have a problem with saying that there is an evil force, whether you would rather say something like our having talked about chaos, whether you would rather say that there is some chaotic force which we haven't, which we can't control, and sometimes it's manifested as evil, either in our personality or in societal manifestations, institutions.
That's a metaphysical force you're talking? Like the chaotic force is metaphysical?
I don't know if that is more metaphysical than talking about a human force. I just wonder if that makes more sense to you too.
What I have problem with is talking about a metaphysical force. It's a separate entity of evil. Okay, beyond the or the non-material or spiritual world, a an active evil force in the non-material world.
You have trouble thinking of that, you said, that there is.
No, I'm not saying I don't have trouble thinking about it. It's just that then it draws to question some of the presuppositions we have about God in a lot of ways, I think.
It'd be similar to saying that those who believed in the devil, as Luther and other people, as a force outside of God, that would also bother you. I mean, is that similar or not? I'm not trying to corner you. I'm just saying, is that a similar kind of thing for you?
Yeah, so.
What you're saying makes sense to me. I mean, I agree with it. That doesn't make sense.
What are the presuppositions that creates that you are not comfortable with about God, if there was a devil?
Well, if God's a total actor, then how does evil? If God's a total actor and omnipotent, as many Lutheran theologies contend, where does evil come into play? Or does God permit that evil to exist? If God is all good.
Yeah.
We have to determine whether God is all good or not. Yeah. Or omnipotent.
I guess so. I thought it seems to me in the giving of the gift of free will, it's all wrapped up with inevitably potential for good and potential for evil. And if you're going to give a gift that big, you have to make room for the possibility, maybe the inevitable conclusion of evil along with good. They just can't exist together unless you have a wound-up toy that's bound to goodness. You know?
I think
Greg, an interesting point. If God is all good, if you accept that premise, then how can any evil come out of good? God is purely good. That's an interesting thought. I mean, even given as a free choice, how could anything evil come out of the good as a free choice?
And then if God is evil and good, so why can I do evil and good? My own choice, choosing. I'll be pleasing God. That's a prayer not too long ago. You know, either way I go, I please God. So why not go to the least resistance? I don't believe that.
Why no Yenna studied this question? I'm just interested in getting a response from her, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, the things that, the problems that are being brought up here are the problems that the traditional, that theology has traditionally run into. And what I've been studying a bit is what process theology says about evil in the face of God. And its starting point is to say that that God created out of chaos, as the Genesis story says, and and that rather than talking about an evil force besides God, he talks about chaos not being inherently evil, but which can take on the form of evil when it's manifested in our world, because chaos can destroy our order, and then we experience it as evil, but it is not in itself evil. And secondly, that that chaos is simply necessary as the basic source from which God creates, but also for the ongoing process of creation, that that nothing creative could happen if there wasn't that chaos as a kind of material to build from. So process theology would say that in that sense, God is responsible for evil because he allows for that chaos to exist, but God has to, because otherwise there wouldn't be creation. But you cannot say that God is indictable. You cannot blame God for willing evil. It is just a necessary part of the process, and without that chaotic element, the world couldn't exist.
So,
does that make sense?
That's really not different from what traditional theology is saying.
Isn't it?
I think where it differs in fact is some places is that instead of looking at God as omnipotent all the time, but God being an influencer rather than a controller, I think there's more of an influencing factor.
May I just clarify, what I have heard as traditional theology is that God created out of nothing. And that creates a problem. Well, where did evil then come from? And then it seems to be implied within God.
It's teaching that it didn't come in creation. It came later on when it was dealing with evil. And it didn't acknowledge the fact that it was there. See, pre-existing chaos is as much a jump of faith as anything else. Those two things you said are two jumps of faith that I think are more requiring of faith than the old tradition. The old tradition says that there was nothing, you know, and then something happened.
Except God.
Yeah, except God, and then something happened. That's a leap of faith. Mm-hmm. To say there was chaos, which has the potential for good and evil. Mm-hmm. Well, how do we know that? That's a leap of faith. It's an equal leap of faith.
But where do you...
Just assume it. But then later on, when it helped, dealt with, not in the creation, in the doctrine of creation, but later on, then admitted that there was something else going on that had that possibility of questioning the omnipotence of God. And then I know of people who are good theologians who have written, but we just have to allow for the fact that in some way God does not stop this evil, whatever we call evil, from happening. And also that it is important in the process of the development of humankind. Unless we are confronted with the counterforce, whatever it may be, there will not be any growth. But they didn't do it in creation, right? And I like the process emphasis, but it has two leaps already.
Mm-hmm. But I think an important starting point is that when you say that God created out of chaos, you give up the notion that God is all power. God is not the only creative power.
Sure. Yeah.
And then you get rid of that problem with how can God be all loving and all powerful at the same time. And process of theology says God is all loving and a persuasive and luring force, and definitely the most powerful force that we encounter in reality, but God is not all powerful.
Changing your base doesn't get rid of the problem. It says, I'm going to ignore the problem this way. That doesn't solve the problem. It doesn't resolve it at all. It just says something else happened that I don't understand, which is a problem.
But if you start from zero, that there is nothing, and God created the cosmos, then the problem exists is how can God create an evil force in the world? If you think if God is good, all good, then you go to the point of how can there be evil in the world if an all good God created?
I understand that, sure. And I don't start from a principle that there was nothing, but a lot of people do.
Mm-hmm.
In connection with what Greg said, that it has been Lutheran theology often to say God is good. And at the same hand, we all know that Luther believed definitely in Satan and so on. Can somebody who has more theological background than I, how did Luther, maybe not solve it, but how did he deal with those two things for himself? Or did he not believe that God is completely good? How did he get Satan in the picture?
I don't think he did resolve it.
What is wrong with saying, or maybe this is just a different interpretation than what you've been saying, that evil, what we call evil, is a creative force that is like a positive and negative,
sure,
like a male and female. I don't know if the males are correct. But I'm saying animus and anima. You know, that there's two. That to create, you need the opposites, and that they can function together.
Now we're taking these generally. Sounds like we're taking good and evil, generally speaking.
But I, you know,
or is this a specific ideology or a situation?
How can we talk? Well, our author mentions this too on page 46 or 47. It's difficult to talk about these things if they're not embedded in our own experience,
mm-hmm,
because then they're just, you know, like building castles in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, from my own experience, I have experienced evil as a creative force in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been welcomed from time to time.
But if there is two forces, it still doesn't solve the problem of how that force became in existence.
Except that that's the nature of things.
Mm-hmm.
But it's my
like,
question, why?
What do you mean the nature of things, as far as that evil is needed
that
for
if,
progress?
That if we knew how to capture that energy, and we could use it to create too, the way that God does. But that's the essence of God's creation, and His power is His knowledge about using those offices to create.
And I don't see that any greater jump than to say there was chaos.
Except I'm saying that that's from my own experience.
Right.
And whereas talking about chaos and those things are categories that
I agree. I'm saying that to lay set yours forward doesn't recall any greater leap of faith for me than to say, well, there was chaos, or to say God has loopholes.
We
start on the premise where we have to have some absolute ending. That's the bad part of the tradition. There has to be an all good. There can't be partially good and still be God. I don't think that many of the theologians of that have really dealt adequately with that, and there's maybe, as he's saying, never experienced it themselves. I don't know.
But I mean, you're saying that if you said that there's a positive force and a negative force, then God could be all good because he wouldn't have anything to do with this negative force. Well, so I mean, then
it wouldn't
you
bother
say,
me whether he was or not, but somebody might be able out of that. Sure. Mm-hmm.
I see the image of the two poles that you can set up a kind of electrical charge between them, and if you remove one, then nothing happens. But it's the electrical charge that is.
That's right. When saying, when you get to the point of saying, okay, the Holocaust was a creative force, and I'm not, I would say that it is, or I'd say I have great difficulty of seeing how it could be. But you know, I would say with the charge, that means that we weren't able to make whatever led to the Holocaust a greater force, and it went to it in its evil way.
What is that?
Killing the Jews in Germany.
See, I
experience that.
I have trouble with that, because to talk about a compassionate God, and then to say, well, we weren't able to contain this force, and then I think we question the interventionism of forces in the world.
Exactly what the people outside the church are saying right at this point. Mm-hmm. How in the world should I believe in Christianity when a compassionate God did not stop the Holocaust? The hell with it. It's the people at Denver State University. Then argue with them.
But, if you look
but has the
Hitler's
church come up with a
too.
Response? I think that's the question.
This is what we're doing. I don't give a rip what the church is. I don't know what we're doing. Here we sit around and wait for somebody else to do it. We're doing it right now. I'm working out a way of doing it for myself because I'm talking to church people. I'm talking to Christian people about that issue. Mm-hmm. You've got to have, as I've said on a number of occasions, you've got to be struggling with it. I think process theology is a good way to work at it. There are other ways. I like George's way. But whether we're going to get some absolute answer, that's out of the old tradition. And we have to have an absolute answer once for all.
I'm not trying to imply that there was no leap of faith. I don't think process theology is either. I think that there will always be a leap of faith. But then within our faith, there is. We can try to explain what is it that we believe in or trust. And there I think we can say some things that are more meaningful than other things. And there I think process theology is a good...
To some people, sure.
No, kind of new perspective. But I don't think that he tries to avoid the jump or to God all the way through like scientific.
Lisa, did you have something you looked like maybe you did? Okay, yeah.
Started to say, then you can look at it from the other side.
Well, I find good and evil is just the personal interpretation of the words. It's just a title put on what you're thinking at the time, such as the Holocaust. We thought it was evil, but Hitler thought, well, that's a good deal. We got rid of those guys. Ice cream, for instance. For one, it could be good, but from a diabetic, that's evil. And then money, and go help the hungry in Ethiopia, that's good. You take it out on the black market and buy drugs, that's evil. So it depends, and then, but if you're the mafia selling the drugs, the money is good.
So evil's a totally subjective experience.
I think it's just a word that we put on our own little whatever it is, since, in my opinion, because I believe God is good. And then, but there's those times like the earthquakes that mudslide out, and that's evil. It seems evil anyway, in our opinions. That's a good a title to put on it as evil. And then Weinberger and Schultz thinks war is wonderful to have around.
In your context, it could be good too, though. It could be good for the people who clean it up.
Right.
Financially, you know, the. It seems like that's really too subjective for me.
It's just I think it's just a title, a definition to explain what is good and evil for ourselves, because the same thing can be good and evil, like ice cream and bombs. And
how about in as much as the creation story, and I'm not saying I follow this literally, but if you would look at it like supposing that Adam and Eve actually did bring on this evil, brought on the, you know, the negative of human nature came out through them, and it was from that, we might say, brought it on to ourselves. That's how it was created, and that's why from then on, I'm not saying I believe that clearly, that simply or literally, but...
But how was it brought on to Adam and Eve? I mean, if you're thinking of the story as narrated in Genesis, it was Satan, and so there was already the evil. Yeah, the creation.
But still, the humans made the choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but don't Phyllis Truman points out that it wasn't just the humans, it was the animal and the vegetable world, too. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
It's all creation. That's why I think
that. And isn't it solar? Is it true that said, you know, it was really a mature choice?
Yeah, makes sense.
To take the apple, the fruit.
There's something about knowledge in there. One of the books say knowledge. Maybe they found out that in this book of knowledge that about evil, they probably were in a world of good. And then there's something about knowledge in there. One of the books say knowledge. Maybe they found out that in this book of knowledge that about evil, they probably were in a world of good. And then read that book of knowledge or the apple or whatever they call it. And found out that, found the word evil.
I guess I agree with Elmer in that, you know, that individuals in the church have been to hang up on coming to an absolute answer. And I don't necessarily believe there is an absolute answer, but we're just trying to come to grips with the individual and corporate thing. One of the trouble I have with this third chapter in the book is that and Yana mentioned this yesterday a bit, is that Kelsey challenges all the conclusions of the noble theologians and philosophers, Kierkegaard, Barth, Bultmann, Kant, Hegel, and Heidegger. Well, that's, you know, since the early 19th century, that's the major theologians and philosophers. And it seems like when Kierkegaard talks about a leap of faith, I mean, if Bakken isn't taking a leap of faith in this non-spiritual stuff, what's your reaction to that? You know, I talked to you a bit about it yesterday. What's your reaction to his, is he incorporating these philosophies and theologies, or is he developing his own framework for philosophical thought?
Just before you answer that we're aware that what's in here is Bakken's interpretation of what Kelsey does, because he's saying Kelsey vigorously challenges. We're not reading anything right here that Kelsey says. Mm-hmm. So it's a little hard for us to know what Bakken is interpreting Kelsey is saying, and so therefore what Kelsey would mean. No, didn't mean to interrupt, but just that we're remembering that.
Well, the noble theologians is what I'm brought up in. And I guess I would say that they're very important, and you probably can't do without their insights. On the other hand, they have been dominating too much so that our theology has become too one-sided, and I'd like to integrate this other side, which I think that Bakken is trying to promote. But for Bakken himself, I think perhaps that he would want to discard those theologians altogether. And that is mainly because of this division between body and mind, where the result then is that you understand God to speak only to your mind, and also the division is between our world here and God's reality up here, and then the word for our reality at certain points, Jesus being the word, but that doesn't allow for understanding God through our own spirituality, our own experience, and understand God as speaking through other means like body, matter, other people, nature. And I think we should have the two integrated.
What do you think that Kelsey or Bakken are building on any predecessors? Or is this something that they're in? Who do you think they're building on if it's not a prior body?
Kelsey, surely.
It's not fair to characterize those two traditions, though. They dealt with this issue and rejected it. And you ought to really deal with why they rejected it, too, before you buy into the new. Because then it's really unfair to them, too. It isn't simply that they didn't know about experience or matter and the possibility of having it. They said no to it. And dealing with those arguments is a very important way of dealing with them. And that's why he says in the second sentence, that Kelsey has the ability to summarize their strengths and their major weaknesses. So I'm assuming what Kelsey's done is try to deal with that part of it too. But simply say they said this and not deal with their arguments against, say, the next is an inadequate way.
And a personal opinion too is that when someone says you vigorously challenge a conclusion, that's not saying either that you outright reject everything about it. We can challenge some of these conclusions right now, and it doesn't mean we're going to reject everything. So I don't think it does mean that he's saying we won't have anything to do with any of their theology. So there's lots of semantics involved.
Elmore, they said no to healing, for example, right?
Yeah. I think most of the time they did, yeah.
That's what Kelsey, my reading last this morning, was saying that they would say that would be absurd to think of healing.
I mean, like a physical healing.
Physical healing, because that allows God to intervene or interject into this world of ours, this boxed off, what they call it, space time, mm-hmm. energy mass, yes. continuum, mm-hmm. I'd like to say. Mm-hmm. That box, you know, that's our territory, and the spiritual world is outside that, it cannot interject. And through prayer, tongues, you know, to cast that out. Dreams.
I think many of them were more careful than that. I don't.
That's what Kelsey was saying. Yeah. He assumed that they would reject these things.
Yeah. Well, I think in general that's absolutely true, but I think there were allowances for things that they had seen and experienced too. But that's true that's what they rejected. But the very subjective thing that was bothering him is what bothered them. Luther, for instance, was highly bothered by the Anabaptists, who got it all from most of them from itself. Mm-hmm. And he says, and eventually, it's whatever you feel like today that is true. And that's not what process theology is saying, you know, for instance. But that's what they fought against. And then there's a rather elaborate thing, too much mm-hmm. of the Lutheran confessions, as far as I'm concerned, are a confrontation of that point of view.
Mm-hmm. And clearly.
So, in other words, if the psychoid side, which I think is an important dimension of them, mm-hmm. which they rejected, was rejected on the basis of their particular experience. What that experience was, I think, is important to know about as we make our choices.
Is there a middle ground for you between those? The inner and the integral Anabaptists and their experiences?
Well, sure.
I guess that's what I'm trying to find here. Yeah, it's the middle ground.
That's where I'm certainly not. I'm wary of simply saying everything that I feel is true.
Right. It's from God directly.
Right. At the same time, I know that God speaks through experience and through, and I think in ways beyond any of our understanding, yet through plants, trees, animals, matter, whatever. In fact, then my question is whether God is a person at all. Whether it is really false. We have to use it as the concepts of personality is very
The trouble I have with the sense of subjectivity in chapter 3, that numinous experience and so on, is that it seems like Bach continually draws on all I can know is what I all I am able to know is what I personally experience. And I guess I have enough faith in the synergy of the corporate body is that I have faith that the corporate body will come into experiences that I can't myself. And I think that's a lot of times the fallacy of saying, well, I can only know what I've experienced myself.
Because John brought up the idea of the rejection by earlier theologians in many cases of physical healing or God interjecting into the world like that. Did anyone choose number 7 to respond to? And you're bringing that up now too about his reliance on what he has actually experienced or has known others to experience in a more concrete way. No one?
Talk about physical health? Holistic
health. Yeah, his definition of health, I believe, was as contrasted to wholeness, wasn't it? That health was dealing with the physical. I believe so, in one of the earlier chapters, I believe he made that contrast. So I think, I took it here that to restore health, he was speaking of physical.
Something in my life I'd like to share, mm-hmm. I don't know how to interpret it, besides, well, I do to some degree, but subjective, of course. Mm-hmm. Talked about dealing with healing, you know, physical level. I felt like when I was 15, I was addicted to cigarettes, for instance. This is an example. So maybe it just jogged my mind thinking mm-hmm. of the time of healing. And I remember the prayer phone line. I called CBN, Christian Broadcasting Network, which is in our area, Virginia Beach, Virginia. And so I called the line up because I wanted to be, wanted to pray over this addiction. And we prayed, you know, for some prayer. A lady answered the phone and prayed over it, asked for healing in Christ's name. And I said I had promised I wouldn't smoke again, you know, I committed myself to that over the lines. Well, I did smoke again. And it was about, I don't know, remember how long, maybe a couple weeks later, maybe not even that long. I probably wasn't. But what happened was it never tasted the same. I don't know. It wasn't satisfying, mm-hmm. and it has, and I tried. I smoked off and on for a long time. I finally quit a couple years ago, completely. I haven't had another cigarette or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. You know, it never was the same again. Is that psychological? Is that, you know, it's coincidental, or is it just faith that there's some healing there? I don't know.
And I always think when we say, is it psychological, what's psychological? Isn't that part of God's creation of us too?
Yeah, psychological. I guess we try to separate them. Mm-hmm. And, where does that lead? Where does it lead me? Am I playing tricks on myself, or is that something really happened at that time?
From readings I've done and so on, I would think that there would be a lot of people who could share something similar like that and have expressed and have looked upon that as God's intervention into
right.
their life.
Something small yet significant to me.
I really got challenged in New Guinea because I grew up feeling that God, that Christ was certainly capable of miracles. I didn't have trouble accepting the miracles as related in the Bible and so on. If this was the God that I was taught to believe in, it certainly seemed possible. But somehow I had had no acquaintance at all with him acting directly in our world in some of these same miraculous ways until I had gotten overseas and began. But the one thing I'm thinking of now where it's very hard to hold on to any feeling that this kind of thing never happens is when you have some direct confrontation then. One of the was not a Lutheran, but a, I think possibly a Baptist, who came out and taught a class at a high school in Papua New Guinea where I was teaching, and had shared with us how his son, who all his life had had one leg shorter than the other and had to go with elevated shoes, had been miraculously healed, and his leg had actually lengthened And you know, what do you say when that boy is right there in front of you with normal shoes on and with no limp and so on? And there was a real, maybe some of you have read about the revival, it was called in Indonesia, one of the islands of Timor, where there were writings and related over and over, just like the early church, you know, there were just almost every kind of miraculous sign and wonder that occurred, including people maybe being in one place and needing to be in another, and just like that, you know, somehow without any knowledge of physical movement, they would have been transported and so on. And then there were many studies done by others trying to ascertain if there was anything to this, and so on. And a part of this movement a little bit was in Papua New Guinea in the highlands area among a group too. And really seemingly some very accurate accounts where it could be directly testified to that true physical acts of healing, even to that kind of thing, restoring or lengthening and so on, had occurred. And ever since then, it's been a real fascinating subject for me to consider whether God is at work in the world in the same way today. Because I grew up very much with a rationalized mind that, you know, people were being deceived or there was some way you could explain that away, sort of thing. I can't anymore because I've known people that I have no reason to say you are not being truthful. You have directly related and shared those kinds of things.
I think it's starting with 3 and 7 to combine them. And when I read it, the 7, I was thinking about the brain being healed. I thought that Allah could do something with his wife, but the healing might not come here, the healing might come either. So, these number 3 and 7. I didn't know what I couldn't say.
I've also thought on 7, or I still don't know. I think we talked about once before in the pastor's group, but why it says the risen Christ can and is willing to restore health through prayer. What's the is willing doing to this one?
One thing, Carol, my response to what you're saying too is that I think when we don't have so much contact, or when there's a diminishing of understanding tribal societies, we also don't see how this kind of spiritual healing is incorporated into the ongoing everyday life of the community. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't. There's a lot of spiritual healing that doesn't seem to be so miraculous, but just as a normal, ongoing process in the community.
Mm-hmm. That just makes me think I should have explained, too. All this I'm talking about in Indonesia and in areas of the highlands of New Guinea, that is among native peoples, but the person I mentioned, that the son whose leg was lengthened, that was an expatriate, Australian, I believe. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My personal experience of healing was through a Jewish psychologist. Mm-hmm. The thing that bothers me is that, you know, Rocket stops and puts his hands around the guy's neck. He's healed. How about the other patients that day? Your question, I believe you were healed. But you said, well, where do we go from here with it? And that's always the question.
Right.
Because when it says then, you know, that, go down the hall, but try out the lodge, you know, why stop in one room?
Yeah.
But it's connected to the question of why Christ healed some and didn't heal some. So, I mean, why he felt called to heal this person and not someone else.
So the question, it isn't important question about where we go from here, or when we experience healing.
I'd like to send everybody to the psychologist in Chicago and die. I did send a lot of people.
One of the things in response to what Carolyn was talking about that I have always questioned is that I guess I don't discount the fact that these kind of physical healings can occur. I guess I've never seen one, but I'm not discounting that they don't. But then it comes to the point of obviously not everybody who has this kind of procedure is healed. Mm-hmm. And how do you establish, or how does one come to terms with why some are healed and some aren't, and what is there a secret to this, or you know, what, how do you come to terms with that?
I hardly know a secret. The only thing I'm thinking of is though, if in some of Agnes Sanford's reading, who has done many healings and so on, but who also is very open about that not everyone is healed and why. I believe her sort of conclusion, the way she's worked it out herself, is that it's because wholeness healing involves all of God's creation. And sometimes there is simply too much, you know, evil or wrong in the whole created world to permit some specific healing to take place too. That there's not going to be specific cases everyone going to be healed until all of creation would be healed and know that wholeness. And of course that isn't true. That's part of her answer to it, I think. Mm-hmm.
So you surround yourself at Holden Village and get healing?
No, there's too many of you people still living in neutral at 7 o'clock in the morning. You didn't see that pink sun on Bonanza and Buckskin this morning. It was tremendous.
Four later?
No.
Everybody got up early. Then we
at 7.
That's okay. Before 7.
A quarter to 7.
A quarter to 7, Chris.
That's when it was the most beautiful.
And where do we have to go?
You have to walk out and get up on the tailings so you can look across at those mountains.
I see. It's by 6:15. Mm-hmm.
Between 6:45 and 7.
And stretching it out.
Getting some specifics.
But whatever this is worth, I keep thinking of it. It struck me, Martin Marty, in the Lutheran tradition, when we were talking about good and evil forces, or God good, or all good, and then now with the healing, a reference is made to Dittmenson folk piety, which knows exactly what God is doing. If it is God's will to turn cells malignant, so be it. If cells turn healthy, God willed it. And so that's saying God's reduced to a manipulated, controlled being. That's a view. Well, a statement that gets me is that, like all theodicy, in the face of suffering, this one does not prove the existence of a loving God or provide a philosophically satisfying answer to the problem of evil. And it's this next statement that gets me. In the end, the Lutheran tradition does not worry too much about these questions because of its very modest view of what reason by itself is and can achieve. I don't know if you follow that. And it's kind of hard to take it out of context in ways, but it's as much as saying, like, you know, all this discussion about where does evil start, or is there evil, or how do you interpret it. In the end, the Lutheran tradition is not really too much about these questions. And, like, we believe that.
Yeah. That's Martin Marty.
That's what you contradict.
I knew he's talking
about these.
Yeah, that sounds very Lutheran to just skirt the whole issue and say, well, so what?
Sounds like the church, you know. Give us a statement on the church's stand on anything. And the church makes me think of Reagan. I mean, you know, say anything and everything, but exactly take a stand.
But I was meaning that in a good way, that it's like the church to, you know, not say, boy, is he really present in the bread, or is it symbolic? Let's just address the fact that we meet God there. Or is the scripture inerrant, or is it totally symbolic? Let's just rest in the fact that we meet God there. And so this issue of, well, is he good but not evil, or not evil, evil but not totally good? The point is, in the midst of this suffering that is very much a part of reality, God is present. And I think they were talking about that in a sacramental sense. Suffering is almost sacramental in the sense of we find grace in the midst of it, just like in the midst of communion or any other sacrament. And so, there's something very workable about that, even though it doesn't make a lot of room for your mind to rest in, probably.
I also can't help but, I'm sure a lot of it has to do with most of my work experience being with children, but thinking about how children presently are being taught, what they're being taught, how we grew up, you know. I don't know, didn't we all have Bible lessons with the devil, and, you know, how are we brought up, and it's ingrained in us, and just as an example, how do we perceive evil as we're growing up, and then
just
points where you question it so greatly, but it's...
Just add something along that line that's always interesting to me in this, these tribal peoples in Papua New Guinea, when they had become acquainted with the Christian Bible stories and Christians and so on, their portrayals of Satan and evil and so on were very vivid, and, you know, way back to like we used to see in kind of Middle Ages and make kind of fun of with the pitchforks and so on. They didn't put the pitchfork, but boy, they really portrayed all kinds of, that made sense to them to really portray
and
Satan
are
as
those portrayals,
yeah.
And
but I mean, that made a lot of sense for them to portray him as really some evil creature.
Do the Iscariot do God's will, his bidding, just as much as Jesus Christ? I mean, because that's what it's sounds ludicrous, but.
Got that one solved. Thanks, George.
Check that one off.
He did. He did. Okay, John.
You wanted a middle ground. There you have it, right in between. Okay. He did. He did. The middle ground.